Ladies and gentlemen, you're about to hear an address by Dr. John Whiting. He originally presented this talk to a country party seminar. The title Dr. Whiting chose for this address was Sickness and Socialism. Dr. Whiting is a medical practitioner, an author, and a renowned opponent of totalitarianism in all its forms. He is especially well known for his fight against fascism, which has as its basic ideology government control of all the affairs of a nation and doesn't permit any opposition. During the Second World War, Dr. Whiting volunteered to fight fascism in Europe, was publicly acclaimed as a hero and presented with the Distinguished Flying Cross for his exploits. Only last year, as chairman of the South Australian branch of the General Practitioner Society in Australia, Dr. Whiting was in the front line of the successful fight against the Dunstan government's announced intention of assuming control over doctors' incomes. For his courage in once again fighting to defend individual rights, this time from a further trend towards fascism in South Australia, Dr. Whiting was rewarded by vicious public denunciations and presented with the threat of 2 years in jail. Having become thoroughly alarmed at the ever-growing power of governments, the cancerous growth of bureaucratic controls, and the erosion of personal freedom, Dr. Whiting recently agreed to become chairman of the newly formed Movement for Limited Government, a politically unaligned body whose aim is to mobilise responsible men and women to the dangers looming on the horizon. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. John Whiting.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, I have chosen as my topic sickness and socialism. Under this heading, I could talk about social security cards, about the alarming drift away from the general practitioner to the specialist, with the resultant escalation of costs. I could talk about differential rebates, about private and public insurance, about Mr. Gorton's $5 gimmickry, about Dr. Forbes's fantasies, about Hayden's hate-inspired hospital scheme, about communist-like community health centres, and about the socialist-proposed universal health insurance that both they and the advertiser lack the intellectual honesty to call by its proper name. Compulsory insurance, to be exacted from you, if necessary, by force. I do not, however, intend to talk on these subjects, for these are the types of topics that Mr. Whitlam and Mr. Hayden would like me to talk about. Yes, even though I disagree with them, they would welcome such a talk, for I would soon have you so lost in a forest of facts and figures that you would be unable to see the sinister shape of Mr. Karl Marx. The more we flit amongst the minutiae of the Labour Party's proposed health scheme, the less likely we are to come to grips with the basic fundamentals, the basic morality, the basic philosophy of the socialist doctrine. Those of you who are interested in the minutiae of the mess that goes by the name of medical politics might like to read about it in my recent book, Wake Up, Mate. For I do not propose to discuss details. I intend to get at the very core of the problem and discuss the philosophy that lies hidden beneath the grandiose phrases of all those who sit on the government benches and many of those who sit on the opposition benches in Canberra. This country is sick and in an almighty mess. If you doubt me, take but a small peep at the picture. Large numbers of young people taking to drugs. At a conservative estimate, 25% of all adults showing some neurotic tendencies. Mediocrity, the order of the day. Shortages of goods. Incentives for brains, drive, skill and hard work virtually non-existent. Strikes, a daily occurrence. One man in four of the working population a bureaucrat who probably produces nothing. Government controls on the increase, individual liberty on the decrease. Universities, havens for academics who are often incapable of thinking rationally, so that many responsible people are having grave anxieties about sending their children to these propaganda factories. Taxation gone mad, incentive destroying company tax, crippling provisional and progressive personal taxes, preposterous probate taxes, and sales taxes like a bad dream. Anything up to 50 separate taxes before the farmer's wheat ends up on your table as a loaf of bread. Inflation running wild, and political ignorance and apathy of an unbelievable degree. One could go on and on and on. Corner a politician and confront him with the facts, and he will possibly admit them. But with a posture that is meant to denote wisdom, he will probably excuse the mess on the grounds that other countries are no better off than we are. He reasons, if one can call it that, that one may excuse a criminal on the grounds that criminals are also to be found in other countries. Okay, let's accept the fact that other countries are also in a mess, for it's true. The United States is, the gun-slinging republics of South America are, the curious collection of African states are, the Iron Curtain countries are, Britain certainly is. One could go on and on. If these countries are in a mess, if our own country is in a mess, a rational man might be tempted to ask why. As far as we know, man is the only living creature that is capable of thinking rationally. That's not to say, of course, that all men think rationally. Most don't. Nevertheless, it's only by employing rational thinking that we can hope to identify the causes of this mess. Would you allow yourself to be operated on by an irrational surgeon? Would you fly in an aeroplane that had been designed by an irrational engineer? Would you swallow medicines that had been formulated by an irrational chemist? If your answer is no, then I ask you, why should you jeopardize your happiness, your prosperity, your liberty by accepting the doctrines of irrational teachers, irrational politicians, and irrational economists? If we want the answers, and the answers are there for the searching, we must learn to use our minds properly. We must learn to shake off our hang-ups, to discard our dogmas, and to keep asking ourselves, why, why? If we can do this with complete honesty, calling a spade, then step by step, the whole hideous picture will unfold. In the process of asking all these whys, we will find that we have become philosophers. Not of the type that is often found in our university philosophy departments, who specialize in meaningless, emasculated verbiage, but proper philosophers. People who are not frightened to examine the nature of man and see him as he is, and not as some people think he ought to be. Do you consider that man is like an ant, doomed to live in an anthill, interdependent upon all the other millions of ants? If you do, then it's consistent to attribute to some of the brighter and harder working ants the role of milch cows, to be milked in order to fulfill the so-called requirements of a non-existent idea, the common good. If you think this way, then whatever you may call yourself, you are in reality a collectivist, a socialist, a communist, a potential dictator, for this is their dogma. From each according to his ability, to each according to his need. If, on the other hand, you look upon man as a potentially noble creature, distinguishable from the animals and the insects, in that he has the capacity to think for himself and to reason rationally, the desire to express himself to the utmost, and the will to devote his life to the attainment of excellence in his chosen occupation, then you will find the anthill concept repugnant. Your rational thought will lead you to the conclusion that men and their countries will wither away and decompose unless each individual is free to make of his own life whatever he chooses, provided that he doesn't trespass on the freedom of others. Let the so-called philosophers in our so-called universities play their puerile little games with words if they so wish, but let us not confuse their mental and verbal gymnastics with true philosophy, for true philosophy is concerned with people. Unless we understand this, we may just as well throw in the towel right now and concede victory to the advocates of the human anthill. If we believe, as I do, that man is a potentially noble creature who is being led into a political and economic morass, then it's imperative that we use our brains in the manner for which our brains are designed and think rationally and honestly to search for the root causes of all our ills. Only thus will we be able to combat evil men with evil ideas and silly men with silly ideas. Evil ideas can only be combated with good ideas, and silly ideas can only be combated by rational ideas. Whether our society continues to sink further into the quagmire or to climb out of it depends solely on our ability to think objectively and rationally, for it is the subjectivists and the irrationalists of all political persuasions who are eroding our liberty, destroying the economy, and undermining the morale of the Australian people. Unless the Australian learns quickly to think with his head rather than with his heart or his mouth, then he's had it. And believe me, there is not much time left for freedom-loving people to get their thinking in order. What are some of the political and economic trends that we're witnessing in this once lovely country? The land of the free is fast becoming a land of controls. Try catching a few fish and selling them to the local fish shop. Try keeping a few fowls and selling the eggs to the man over the road. Farmers, try selling your wheat to your neighbour. Or if you live on Kangaroo Island, try painting your sheds in your favourite colour. Drivers, try leaving off your seat belts. If you're an employer, try telling the tax commissioner that you're going on strike as you're fed up with working under duress as his unpaid tax collector. If you run a deli and you find that your rewards are inadequate for a 16-hour working day, put a cent or two on your bread and milk and see what happens. One could go on. Controls and more controls. Administering these controls are the bureaucrats, a million of them. One in four of the working population. One in four of the descendants of the once tough, fair, dinkum, independent Aussies is today a bureaucrat, probably pushing a pen, producing nothing, yet propped up in his job by you, the taxpayer. The rugged Australian farmer is still dogged by drought, but it's likely that crippling taxation and vindictive probate laws are just as big a worry to him. And what about inflation? Out of control and affecting every man, woman and child in the country. Now let's take a closer look at the few topics that we've mentioned. Controls. Who imposes them? Governments. Freedom. Who erodes it? Governments. Who builds up huge bureaucratic empires? Governments. Who robs you in the name of the law and cripples you with those multitudinous taxes? Governments. Who creates inflation? Governments. I repeat, governments. You might ask, if governments create inflation, why do they become so disturbed about it? Why, you might ask, did the present government go through the charade of a referendum on the subject if they create the inflation? If governments create inflation, why do employers blame the workforce? And why does the workforce blame the employers? At any rate, you might ask, what does a GP know about all this? He's a doctor, not an economist. After all, didn't the great Professor Galbraith himself tell us that the way to stop inflation was to control prices and incomes? Didn't 16 clever Australian professors of economics sign a petition stating that the way to stop inflation was to control prices and incomes? Surely you say these clever men must have known what they were talking about, in spite of the fact that such a policy has been proved ineffective. What would you think of a doctor whose suggested treatment for acute appendicitis was the giving of pain-relieving drugs rather than operating to remove the diseased organ? I would suggest to you that you wouldn't go back to him, as in all likelihood you'd be dead. Yet your 16 clever professors of economics would behave in the same way as this doctor. They would treat the symptoms and tell you that your disease will now go away. No, ladies and gentlemen, inflation is caused by huge government deficit spending. The spending of money that it hasn't got. To overcome the shortage caused by its extravagant spending, it borrows money, thus creating new money. Put crudely, they turn the handle of the printing presses. Instead of $100 chasing an article, we now have $120 or $150, $200, $500, $1,000 chasing the same article. Have a guess what happens to prices. That, ladies and gentlemen, is inflation. If you and I were to act in a similar fashion to governments, we would be arrested and sent to jail for counterfeiting. Inflation could be stopped tomorrow if Mr. Whitlam and his gang really wanted it. That some of your politicians should deceive you should not come as a surprise. That most of your newspaper men should be ignorant of elementals should not come as a surprise. That when 16 apparently learned university professors come out and talk rubbish on their chosen topic, then this should prompt you to ask, what the hell's going on? The grotesqueness of the answer is one of the most damning indictments of our modern universities, which in certain faculties have become little more than indoctrination centres for the propagation of socialist and communist philosophies. These so-called learned men lack the intellectual honesty to re-examine their original premises. They swept truth aside to avoid shattering their own preconceived ideas of the blessings of the human anthill. Inflation is inseparable from welfare statism, collectivism, socialism, call it what you will. And when inflation gets completely out of hand, the government who creates the inflation now says that it will stop it. Not by curtailing its deficit spending, but by imposing controls on you. Controls, the ultimate weapon of the tyrant and his buddies, who now sit on top of the anthill and manipulate you like puppets on a string. Men and women, of all shades of political opinion, take heed. For all of the political parties, to varying degrees, are infiltrated with people holding these or similar views. The charade of the recent referendum on prices and incomes was not aimed at controlling the rate of inflation. Nothing would have alarmed Mr. Whitlam more. It was enacted to give the impression of fighting inflation, whilst in reality continuing to ensure it. This is a measure of the humbug that is the hallmark of the socialist politician. You might ask, what has this to do with medicine? My answer is everything. In essence, what is the one factor above all others that is common to most of the medico-political problems today? The answer is inflation. The costs of running a hospital are steadily rising. So the cost to you of a bed in that hospital is rising. Doctor's expenses are rising. Therefore, his fees are rising. As his income rises, his taxation rate rises. As his earnings now become less, his fees go up again. It's like a horrible nightmare from which there is no awakening so long as people continue to elect irresponsible politicians to power. The gap between medical and hospital charges on the one hand and insurance rebates on the other widens. The dirty doctors are cheating you again, screams Mr. Hayden, the collectivist, the socialist, the advocate of the human anthill. Filthy rich, vermin, exploiters of the public, dirty fascist pigs, cry communist union bosses. The more fanatical the socialist, the more irrational and vehement the language. The issues are now well and truly clouded, as they're intended to be. The press, more often than not, totally ignorant of the true nature of the issues, jumps on the bandwagon and quickly transforms the instigator of the chaos into a hero and his victim into a villain. The instigator of the chaos comes out smelling like a rose, whereas his victim comes out smelling like a sewage farm. Ladies and gentlemen, men who can twist the truth so skillfully and turn one good man against another are not just silly men. They are evil men. Should you ever listen to the fanatical socialists attacking what they call the bourgeois capitalists, don't be misled. One might get the impression that they want to destroy this section of the community. Let me assure you that nothing would frighten them more, for it is on this group of people that their whole livelihood depends. Without this group, there would be no one to design their television sets, their motor cars, their washing machines, their refrigerators. No one to cure them of their diseases or manufacture their life-saving drugs. No one to save their decaying teeth, and no one to design the machinery that makes their standard of living possible. What man in his right mind would kill the goose that lays the golden egg? For without men such as these, their civilization would crumble and be hurled back 1,000 years. No, ladies and gentlemen, not even the most fanatical of socialists wants this class of people destroyed, in spite of what they say. For by destroying them, he destroys himself. His hate campaign is really aimed at discrediting this group of people so that he may more easily control it. He knows that the men and women of ideas, the individualists, the men of brains, the producers, are the most vital group of men and women in his society. Shout that from the rooftops, and you will expose his shoddy little game. The medical profession is merely the first on their list. Mr. Hayden envisages the day when every single doctor in this country will be answerable to a bureaucrat in Canberra. If this day ever arrives, then you, the public, with your social security cards in hand, will have to put up with any standard of medicine that a disillusioned doctor might feel like dispensing. One of the most disastrous aspects of our educational system is not only that our youngsters are conditioned to think irrationally, but also that they're taught to think in terms of labels rather than in terms of ideas. Thus, we have our blind followers of the Liberal Party, the Country Party, the Labour Party, the DLP and all the rest. So that in most cases, people have only a hazy idea as to what they're voting for. Any politician of any party knows that he has only to use a string of emotive but meaningless phrases and he will capture an audience in their votes. How often do you hear these evergreens? Equality for all, freedom from want, democracy, the common good, the public interest, the needs of the people. As an exercise, ladies and gentlemen, sit down one night and try to decipher what they really mean. If we discard meaningless verbiage and labels, we find that there are basically only three possible forms of government in any country. Better known as totalitarianism, total government. This is a system in which one man or a group of men assume that they know what is best for everyone, and they then proceed to beat everyone into line for what they term the common good. Do you recognize that anthill again? Into this category fall the international socialists or communists, the National Socialists, or Nazis, with their cousins the Fascists, and the Fabian Socialists, such as the British and Australian Labour Parties. Don't pick me up and tell me that the British and Australian Labour Parties are not yet completely totalitarian, for I know it. But let me remind you that the philosophy of the Australian Labour Party and that of their communist friends in Russia is the same. Both stem from the same source, the teachings of Karl Marx. The only difference is that the shortcut is socialism on the revolution rather than by evolution. The second form of government is a limited government, a system of government in which its powers are severely restricted by the Constitution so that the individual's freedom is protected at all times, being limited only to the extent that he must not infringe the freedom of others. Into this grey area fall a strange mixture of political parties, including the so-called anti-socialist parties. If we get confused at times by hearing a nominally anti-socialist party referred to as a socialist party, it is worth considering objectively that party's place in the political spectrum. Is it veering more towards welfare statism? If it is veering more towards statism, having socialist tendencies, this is the reason
why many disenchanted people are refusing to cast the Australia Party, which veers far towards the collective socialist end of the political spectrum. Similarly, many people view with considerable alarm a similar drift within the Liberal Party, in spite of its high-sounding but meaningless utterances to the contrary. I suggest that you look at the Country Party and make up your own minds as to which way it is veering. If we exclude many of the so-called intellectuals and most of the union bosses, then it's probably fair to state that most people who understand the true nature of socialism have no wish to adopt it. Nevertheless, this evil is spreading. It is growing because its victims, being devoid of a sound moral philosophy themselves, concede the basic moral principles of their opponents. Unless we challenge these premises, we have the basis of socialism is the altruist morality. The altruist claims that man has no right to exist for his own sake, and that self-sacrificial service to others is the only moral justification for his existence. The only political theory consistent with such a moral doctrine is collectivism, which in all its variants, socialism, communism, fascism, Nazism, or welfare statism, claims that the individual is of no consequence, for his life belongs to the state. An all-powerful bureaucracy claims a wisdom superior to that of society's individual members. Should the individual disagree, then he's beaten back into line to ensure what the collectivist calls justice for all. The socialist sees nothing immoral in looting from the vigorous, from the men of ability, from the hard workers, and from the thrifty. He goes even further and raises parasitism to the level of a moral ideal. I don't know, ladies and gentlemen, what you call that, but I personally call it a philosophy that is anti-human. The strategy of the Whitlam administration, as of all welfare statists, consists of attempting to make people accept certain intellectual package deals without explaining to them the full implications of the deal. The deadliest of all such package deals is the attempt to make people accept the collectivist, altruist principle of self-sacrifice under the guise of mere kindness, generosity, or charity. It is done by hammering into people's minds the idea that the satisfying of some people's needs takes precedence over individual freedom. They decree that the need of one man is justification to hold a first mortgage over the life of another. They decree that everything, including individual freedom, should be sacrificed to what they call the public interest. The one and only body within the medical profession that has seen clearly the full implications of the collectivist, altruist philosophy and its evil has been the General Practitioners Society in Australia. The rest of the profession, led by the AMA and the Royal Australian College of General Practitioners, is white-anted by followers of the collectivist, altruist philosophy. The leaders of these bodies find any amount of fertile soil for the propagation of their ideas in the minds of many of their philosophically bankrupt members. No political or professional group can hope to win, nor does it deserve to win, if it is unable to identify the true nature of its enemy's philosophy. Socialism in the Western world was almost dead 25 years ago, but it has survived and prospered only because there was no political party confident enough of its own philosophy to fill the vacuum following the socialists' near demise. It was the gaping holes in the philosophies of the anti-socialist parties which allowed the socialists a breathing space to regroup and exert an influence on this country and on the world out of all proportion to the numbers of its true adherents. I should now like to talk about the mandate, one of Mr. Whitlam's favorite words. Mr. Whitlam, according to Mr. Whitlam, has a mandate to do all sorts of things to all sorts of people. Mr. Whitlam, according to Mr. Whitlam, has a clear mandate to do what he damn well likes to one important minority group, the doctors. Mr. Whitlam proves it to you by throwing up democracy in your faces. Did he not receive the numbers in the Democratic poll? The answer is that he did. Where then lies the inconsistency? I will tell you, and I will shock you, for the answer lies in the word democracy, which by definition is the theory of unlimited majority rule. In plain language, it is ruled by men with the biggest gang. It shocks you, doesn't it? Some of you may remember how last year Mr. Dunstan threatened me with all sorts of nasty things. He was determined to use the power of government, the mandate given to him constitutionally and democratically, to break me. He lost only because I understood the true nature of his tyrannical actions. Compare the actions of this socialist with those of men living in a free and just society under a government at the other end of the political spectrum, a government of limited powers. Could Mr. Dunstan have behaved as he did? The answer is no, for in a free and just society, individual rights are sacrosanct, and individual freedom is the most treasured possession that men can own. They are not privileges to be looted by the majority, nor plotted against by a minority. Unfortunately, most people have no clear concept of what democracy means. Most people use the term in some vague sort of way to imply a God-given system of government that is in some unexplained manner synonymous with justice. Can one blame them when politicians, school teachers, university academics, pseudo-intellectuals, clerics, and newspaper editors all glorify the word and castigate the man who dares to point out the glaring abuses perpetrated in its name? Democracy is majority rule, and as such is the perfectly fashioned tool, if used with skill, by which one group of men may deprive others of their freedom. Many people today are confused and uncertain as to whether they're morally obliged to accept the rulings of a majority should these infringe on individual freedom. In a civilized society, the answer is clear-cut. They are not, nor should they be, for majority rule, without protection for the individual or minority groups, can lead only to pure collectivism, to pure totalitarianism. I should now like to talk about service. In a free society, men deal with one another by voluntary, uncoerced exchange, by mutual consent, to mutual profit, each man pursuing his own rational self-interest, none sacrificing himself to another. On a free market, all values, whether goods or services, are traded, not given away. What does the collectivist, altruist, the welfare statist, the socialist, the communist mean by service? He means the exact opposite. He means unrewarded, self-sacrificial, unilateral, compulsory giving whilst receiving nothing in return. It is this selfless service to society demanded of the individual at the point of a gun that he demands of all men. If you think that I'm exaggerating, try withholding some of your money from the taxation commissioner, explaining to him that you do not choose to contribute to the welfare of bums who refuse to work. Another grotesque phenomenon of our times is the fact that this package deal of service is propagated not merely by self-proclaimed socialists and communists, but by many of those who claim to be anti-socialists. Many members of the Liberal Party, and I'm ashamed to say even some members of the Country Party. The leaders of the IMI, most newspaper editors, and the leaders of many church groups. Only recently, we heard the Reverend R.C. Mathias, President General of the Methodist Church, urging his flock to accept the principle, from each according to his ability, to each according to his need. The unadulterated dogma of the communists. So many of our so-called leaders in all walks of life are intellectually sterile, devoid of any political philosophy, rudderless and morally bankrupt, who cling desperately to the collectivist ethic of altruism. They never miss a chance to tell us that service to others, whether this be to our customers, our clients, our patients, or consumers in general, is the moral justification of a free society. With the intellectual dishonesty of the hypocrite, these men choose to evade the question as to whether such services are to be paid for or given away. If one's primary goal is the welfare of others, how can anyone but a hypocrite ask for fair payment for a fair service? Why should not the consumer, the client, or the patient demand of the producer, whether he be a builder, a baker, a farmer, or a doctor, a service as his right, and dictate the terms and conditions to suit his own purpose? If medicine in this country is ever socialized, the people will have no one to blame but themselves for heeding the altruistic Judases of the AMA and the Royal Australian College of General Practitioners, for heeding the sickly platitudes of newspaper editors, for heeding the moralizing of immoral clerics and the nonsense churned out by intellectually degenerate academics. For these are but some of the conditioners who preach the altruist ethic without understanding the full implications of their high-sounding but poisonous phrases. Doctors are not the servants of their patients. No free man is a servant of those with whom he deals. What do you think the rank and file unionist would say if we told him that he was the servant of his employer? He would probably spit in our faces, for he knows that if he's to be free, he must trade his services with the employer. Likewise, the doctor is a trader, as all free men must be in a free society. Only if we are unafraid to call a spade, only if we are able to identify the so-called morality of the socialists and their fellow travellers, can we hope to defeat them. If we lack the courage and the intellectual honesty to challenge the morality of altruism, we will all, sooner or later, end up on the trash heap as slaves of the state.
even in 1974, most people in Australia are not scroungers, bludgers, and parasites who seek the unearned, in spite of the massive propaganda campaign of the altruists who batter people's brains with the concept that they have a right to exact unearned tribute from hard-working men and women of all trades. One man's need is not, and never can be, justification to beat another man into line. Certainly not in a civilized society. But this is the very dogma that the socialist holds dear to his heart. His dogma is incompatible with justice, incompatible with reason, and incompatible with freedom. As a dogma, as a philosophy, it is degenerate. The successors of the socialist ideology, if one may grace it with such a name, are due solely to the philosophical inadequacies and woolly thinking of their opponents. Opponents who hope to stop the trend to collectivism by accepting the very same altruist philosophy themselves. How, I ask, can a man win an argument with a fool if he accepts the irrational reasoning of the fool? How can a man conquer evil if he accepts the basic tenets of the evildoer? How can a man hope to be free if he accepts the basic philosophy of the slaver? For this is what every non-socialist party has done to varying degrees for as long as I can remember, even going back to the era of Mr. Menzies. In conclusion, I would like to say a few words about compromise. Time and time again, we are taught that a reasonable man compromises. We are told that a wise man takes the middle of the road. If you doubt me, read some of the waffle that goes by the name of editorial in your daily newspapers. We are told repeatedly that the man who refuses to compromise is an extremist. If this be the definition of an extremist, then even at the risk of being misinterpreted by some journalist sitting in the audience, I will state categorically here and now that I am an extremist. For I will not compromise my principles for any politician, for any newspaper editor, for any cleric. I believe in individual freedom and human dignity. I do not believe that under any circumstances in a just society, one man's need can be an excuse to beat another man into line. Ladies and gentlemen, one cannot compromise with a rattlesnake. One cannot compromise with a communist or a socialist. One cannot compromise with a fascist. One cannot compromise with a slaver. One cannot compromise with a liar. One cannot compromise with a fool. But this, we are told, is what a reasonable man does. Certainly, if two people agree on principles, they may compromise on the methods by which these principles are put into effect. But only a moral bankrupt, a compromiser, will sink to the depths of sacrificing his principles for the sake of expediency. What would you think of your doctor if he endangered your health by compromising with the bacteria that were threatening your life? I suggest that you would consider him either a knave or a fool. Why then do you not apply the same standards to the politician who jeopardizes your health, your happiness, and your freedom? Ladies and gentlemen, if you want to halt inflation, understand the thinking of those who create inflation. If you wish to halt the impending economic chaos, understand the thinking of those who create the chaos. If you value justice, understand the thinking of those who would subvert justice. If you value freedom, understand the thinking of those who would deprive you of that freedom. The title of this seminar is Australia, where to? Whether the answer is to be slavery or freedom will depend upon people such as yourselves and on your ability to think rationally and honestly.
Copies of this address may be obtained either in writing or on tape spool, cassette or cartridge by writing to the Freedom Enterprise Bookshop, 408 King William Street, Adelaide, South Australia 5000.